Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 272 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This is going to be series 44, and hopefully you find it to be pretty high yield. I essentially want to start this thing where, as I'm making audio podcasts, I also put them on YouTube because, you know, some people just are not podcast people. They just rather listen to YouTube. So I imagine that probably going forward, most of the content I put on the website, I'll also just upload them to the YouTube channel as well. And if you see me looking down, I'm just trying to make sure that the recording, because I'm also trying to record the podcast at the same time, I'm just trying to make sure that the recording is coming through as well nicely so that I can, you know, again, basically just trying to find more ways to put out this material to as many people as possible. And just as an announcement, if you're interested in the Step 2 CK comprehensive course and the MBME test taking strategies course I'm having coming up, you know, starting on Thursday. The test taking strategies course is on Thursday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. And then the 10-hour comprehensive Step 2 CK course is going to be split into 2 days. It's going to be on Friday the 13th and Saturday the 14th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on both days. Again, we'll cover like the high yields from IM, neuro, surgery, peds, OB-GYN, and psych over a 10-hour period, integrated fashion. And again, many people have, probably about 500 people have gone through the course at this point, and I've gotten a ton of very good feedback from it. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the contact me button on the website, and we'll proceed from there. Okay, so let's get right into it, right? So on MBME exams, what is the biggest risk factor for polyhydramnios? What is the biggest risk factor for polyhydramnios on an MBME exam? I would encourage you to think more along the lines of maternal diabetes. The thing is, I hear this complaint from many people that, oh, they gave me a patient and they gave me multiple risk factors, and then I have to, and all those things are risk factors for the same disease, and I have to pick out one. The thing I would just encourage you to do is, there are certain patient-specific risk factors where they will say something like a particular patient population, and what is ordinarily the biggest risk factor for that problem is not going to be the risk factor that is correct for that patient. So you essentially almost have to evaluate things on a patient-by-patient basis to be in good stead on your exam, right? So on MBME exams, probably like 80 to 90% of the time, whenever they give you a question about like polyhydramnios, right? It's usually going to be in a woman that, you know, has maternal diabetes, right? Maternal diabetes, because think about it. If a mom has diabetes, well, she's going to have a ton of glucose in her bloodstream. All that glucose is going to get to the baby's bloodstream through the placenta. And then, again, the baby is not like some zombie or something, right? The baby is metabolically active. So the baby's pancreatic beta cells will be like, okay, well, this is way too much glucose, right? So they start making a ton of insulin. And also all that glucose will also show up in the child's urine. So the child is going to pee more. And as the child pees more, you're going to see more urine being made. Because remember, amniotic fluid is essentially, for all intents and purposes, baby piss, right? So essentially, the more the baby pees, the more you're going to see fluid in the amniotic sac, right? Again, remember, there are many things that can cause polyhydramnios on an MBME exam, right? I mean, again, as long as you understand the cycle that essentially what a baby does is a baby pees and swallows it back, and then pees and swallows it back. That's kind of like the cycle of amniotic fluid, right? So the thing is, if you understand that cycle, you're pretty clear on the causes of polyhydramnios. For example, if a baby does not remember to swallow, say for example, that baby has an encephaly, right? When the anterior neuropore fails to close, and then the amniotic fluid pretty much wears away the child's brain, right? That's going to cause polyhydramnios on an MBME exam, right? Because the baby is not swallowing. So the baby is peeing, but it's not swallowing. Well, there's nowhere for that amniotic fluid to go. So it's going to build up and the baby is going to have polyhydramnios. Another cause of polyhydramnios is if the baby has some kind of obstructive lesion, right? So say, for example, let's say the baby has like duodenal atresia or esophageal atresia or the TE fistula, right? Things of those of that nature. The baby can swallow, but again, kind of think of it as like heart failure. This is like GI tract failure, right? So you have an obstruction. That obstruction will essentially prevent the swallowed amniotic fluid from going through. So the baby will not be able to swallow after a while, and then it will just build up, right? And then you have polyhydramnios under those circumstances. Another thing that could potentially cause polyhydramnios on an NBM exam is if for some reason there are just many babies, right? There are just multiple sources of piss, right? So if, for example, instead of having one baby, you have like twins or triplets or quadruplets, well, they're just more contributors to that piss pool, if you may, right? So because you're having more contributors to that pool, essentially what's going to happen is you're going to have polyhydramnios under those circumstances, right? And then if you're like, oh, Divine, what will cause oligohydramnios? That's easy. Whatever will make the baby not pee is going to cause oligohydramnios, right? The classic one you're probably used to is like Potter sequence, right? Like whenever a kid has renal agenesis, if you have renal agenesis, well, unfortunately, you're not going to be making any pee. If you don't make any pee, I don't know where that amniotic fluid is going to be coming from, right? So that's just one of those weird, bizarre, but high-yield things you want to know for exams. Another unusual one you may see on a test is like vesicle urethral reflux. Or if a kid has like posterior urethral valves, the baby can pee, but the pee has nowhere to go. So if the pee has nowhere to go, the baby is going to have oligohydramnios under those circumstances, right? So hopefully with that, you kind of understand what, you know, the big thing with oligohydramnios and polyhydramnios. Although on NBM exams, when a woman is in labor, the biggest risk factor for oligohydramnios in that patient would just be a rupture of membranes, right? When you rupture your membranes, well, that when they say, oh, a woman's water has broken, what do you think comes out of that water is broken? It's amniotic fluid, right? So if your water is broken, obviously your amniotic fluid index is going to be low. You're going to have oligohydramnios under those circumstances. So again, if you notice, I'm beginning to go with this bent of like patient-specific risk factors, so that again, you're prepared for those kinds of things on an exam, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this is like a 19-year-old female, and they tell you that she's like a star on the sports team, or, you know, they can make her a supermodel, essentially. And then they tell you that, you know, she has a BMI of like 17, you know, very slim, doesn't have much weight, right? And they tell you that she has irregular menses. And they can say, which of the following is the most likely health hazard that this patient will experience over the next like 3 to 5 years or something like that? I would really hope that in those circumstances, you're thinking along the lines of osteoporosis, right? The biggest risk factor for osteoporosis, right, in a patient that is very young, right, you should be thinking more along the lines of the person potentially having like some HPG axis anomaly, usually because they are not eating, right? So that's the thing that's known as athletic amenorrhea. Because if you think about it, if, for example, you're not eating, then your body is like, okay, I don't have enough food to support you. Well, I'm definitely not going to be having any amount of food to support some other human being. So the thing that's going to happen is your body's going to shut down your HPG axis. You're not going to have GnRH. You're not going to have FSH-LH, right? So you're not going to make estrogen. And remember that estrogen has a bone protective effect. I mean, think about it. Why do you think women that become postmenopausal start having all these fractures? It's because they don't have estrogen anymore, right? If you remember, estrogen, because for whatever bizarre reason, your friends at the MBME for Step 2CK, they've started writing these questions where they're beginning to see if you can understand some throwback pathophase from Step 1. Essentially, right, why does estrogen protect bone? Well, remember that estrogen, it increases the synthesis of a key protein known as osteoprotegrin, right? Osteoprotegrin, the way that thing works is that it pretty much causes you to, it's like a dummy receptor for the RANK ligand. So whenever, you know, PTH is activated and it activates an osteoblast, remember PTH does not directly activate osteoclasts, right? PTH will activate the osteoblast first. The osteoblast will express the RANK ligand, and then the RANK ligand will bind to the RANK receptor on the osteoclast. And then that's going to cause the osteoclast to be activated, and then it then resorbs bone, right? So the thing that happens is osteoprotegrin is a dummy receptor for RANK ligand. So that osteoprotegrin will bind up the RANK ligand. When it binds up the RANK ligand, then RANK is not going to find any, so the RANK receptor on osteoclasts is not going to find any RANK ligand around to bind with, right? So your bone is then protected. In fact, this is essentially how the drug known as denosumab works, right? So remember, denosumab is a monoclonal antibody against like the RANK ligand that can be used to treat osteoporosis. I know some of you may be like, oh, Divine, there's no way they can ever test this on an exam. Okay, well, I'll let you think about that some more. Why do you think I'm laughing, right? Those are things that your friends at the MBME routinely test on Step 2CK, routinely test on Step 3. So again, it's just one of those high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And let's make sure that this thing is recording right. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, you know, this patient very sick, is in the ICU, right? They can even make this a COVID question, right? So they'll give you a question about a patient very sick in the ICU. The patient is not doing well at all, right? The patient has been on a ventilator, and they tell you that, oh, this patient is on 100% FiO2, right? But the patient's PaO2 is like 100 or something like that. You may be like, oh, divine, this person's PaO2 is 100. They're on 100% FiO2. Everything is good. That is not good. I'll tell you that right now. The thing is, when your FiO2 is 100%, your PaO2 better be like in the hundreds, like 300, 400, 500 kind of deal. If it's very low, then you are thinking that, okay, this person, like that 100% FiO2 is not really helping that patient out, right? So this patient in that case obviously has ARDS of some sort, right? I would not be surprised if your friends at the NBME, they make a COVID question, because again, it's a very popular health issue in this day and age. If they make a COVID question, an ARDS style question, right? So again, just something to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? So this person, remember, one of the hallmarks of ARDS, right, is when they have a very low PaO2 to FiO2 ratio. Again, that ratio should be much higher than 1, right? Because essentially, this person's PaO2 is like 100, and the FiO2 is 100%, that's like 1, right? So like 100%, 100%, that's 1, right? So that PaO2 to FiO2 ratio is not good. So if a person has ARDS, what do you need to do for those folks? Well, usually, the smart, prudent thing you want to do is you want to, you know, essentially put them on a ventilator. That's like the first thing, right? But you want to use what is known as a lung protective strategy, right? So what in the world do I mean by a lung protective strategy? I mean that you basically give them, you know, as much FiO, I mean, like, you want to give them like low tidal volumes and high PEEP, right? So your PEEP can go as high as you can, you know, don't be afraid to give them as a PEEP as high as 20 on an NBME exam. There's nothing wrong with that. The minimum PEEP you can ever give to a patient on a vent is 5, right? So if a patient is on 5, you absolutely have room to go on an NBME exam. You can even go beyond 20, especially when the person has a very severe case of ARDS. And remember that when people have ARDS, right, when they have, you can hear crackles in the lungs, right? Whenever you hear those crackles, remember, that's an example of a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? Remember, the pathophys behind the ARDS is they have like a systemic inflammatory state, and they're releasing all these nasty things like histamine and bradykinin and all that fun stuff. And those things, right, will cause an increase in vascular permeability. When you increase that vascular permeability, well, fluid is going to seep into your lung parenchyma, right? And that's going to cause hypoxia, because the exchange of oxygen, right, between all that fluid and all that stuff is super inefficient, right? So because it's a non-cardiogenic cause of pulmonary edema, obviously that person is going to have like a normal pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. So the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure in those circumstances should be less than 18. That's a magic number. You want to make sure you commit to memory on NBME exams. And then what if they give you a question and ask, oh, what is the biggest risk factor for ARDS? Again, they will give you all these different things. They will put like malignancy, blah, 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 trauma, drowning, blah, 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 blah. Again, the biggest risk factor for ARDS, believe it or not, is actually sepsis. When a person is septic, they have a very high risk of getting ARDS. But again, remember, ARDS, the things you want to do for those folks that will help them is you want to essentially, again, lung protective strategies, low tidal volume, high PEEP. And then you also want to place those patients in a prone position. So those patients, you want them lying down on their belly, right? It's going to help with opening up their airway and increasing the efficiency of their lung mechanics, right? So again, it's just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then one other thing I want to talk about is an ethical scenario that your friends at the NBME will be very happy to throw in on the exam in this day and age, right? So let's assume they give you a question about a patient. You know, this patient has COVID. This patient is in the ICU, blah, 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 blah. And you're a medical student or some kind of healthcare professional taking care of that patient, right? Let's say you've had this patient for 10 days. And then in the NBME question, they tell you that the patient suddenly goes into cardiac arrest. But then they tell you that there's no personal protective equipment available, right? There are no gowns, no N95s, nothing. Again, I know some of you may be like, Divine, there's no way they can ever test this. I'm telling you, they can absolutely test this, right? If you're those questions that are supposed to start coming from tomorrow, from the 11th of November, with those healthcare systems and all those things, these are the kinds of questions they love to throw under these circumstances, right? So, you know, the patient goes into cardiac arrest, and then they can say, what is your next best step in management? Your next best step in management should be that you should try to find someone that has PPE that can help the patient, right? Obviously, your friends at the NBME, they will supply an answer where you run into the room because, you know, there's no PPE available. You run into the room to try to help the patient. Don't do that. If you do that, I promise you, that'll be the wrong thing to do on an NBME exam. I know it may sound like very callous, like, oh, wow, Divine, you're leaving this patient to die. Didn't we take this oath as physicians to do no harm? Yes, we took that oath as physicians to do no harm. But the thing is, if you run into that room to save that patient, right, and then you get COVID, unfortunately, you will then begin to do harm to other patients that you may see, and you may also begin to do harm to your other healthcare co-workers, right? This is a classic ethics question they can pump into the exam, right? And also remember, God forbid, if in getting COVID you die, right? Well, guess what? There are thousands of patients you would have seen over your career, right? That you don't get to see because you've got COVID and you've died from COVID. And obviously, it's going to be a big hit to your family as well, right? If you look at all the years you've invested to become a physician, all that just goes down the drain, right? So just be mindful of that, right? Obviously, before you get into a on an NBME exam, before you run into a patient's room, right? You always want to make sure that you have appropriate personal protective equipment. Again, that's very high yield to know that for exams. So I've been going for like 16 minutes now. Maybe let me discuss like one or two other scenarios. And then we will, I guess, ultimately proceed from there and then go ahead and stop. So one other thing I want to talk about, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is an alcoholic and then they ask for the biggest risk factor for alcoholism in that patient? Let me tell you this. The biggest risk factor for alcoholism in general on NBME exams. Again, I know some people will say that, oh, Divine, but I saw in this QBank they said this and that and this and that. Let me tell you this right now. Whenever I make podcasts, I don't make podcasts for QBanks. Obviously, you're going to do really well on QBanks if you know everything I'm covering in this podcast, right? But the thing is, whenever I make podcasts, I make them for what the NBME wants you to know, right? Like I know, for example, many people will be like, oh, if a person has C-spine injury, you're supposed to get like a CT, right? You're supposed to get a CT scan. That's pretty much what people do in many EDs around the country. That's what most clinicians do. And that's what many QBanks will tell you to do. Or if a person has, you know, you are worried about C-spine trauma, let's go ahead and do like a CT of the head and neck or whatever, right? But I tell you right now, if you do that on an NBME exam, I'm promising you, you will get the question wrong, right? When you're worried about like C-spine trauma on an NBME exam, you're supposed to perform a cervical neck X-ray, right? You heard me say that, a cervical neck X-ray, right? Or you can say like a lateral neck X-ray. That's another way they can present that, right? So that's what you do when you're suspicious or you're worried about some kind of C-spine trauma on an NBME exam, right? So in this scenario that I'm discussing, right? So if a person is an alcoholic, what is the biggest risk factor on NBME exams for alcoholism? It's actually having a parent that is an alcoholic. In general, people that have parents that are alcoholics, they have like a fourfold increased risk of becoming alcoholics in the future, right? Which should not be entirely surprising to you. Now, another classic question that your friends at the NBME have started caring about in this day and age is whenever a person, you know, like they may ask, they may give you a question about a child, or they may even show you like a fetal heart rate tracing, and you notice that, wow, you're seeing like all these variable D cells, right? You're seeing all these variable D cells. And then they can ask you about like, what is the most likely heart rate response in the fetus, right? That's like, you know, responsible for all this stuff. Basically, what they're trying to ask you is, whenever you see variable D cells, obviously, you know, it's going to be from cord compression, right? What happens to the fetal heart rate when you have cord compression? And what is the mechanism behind that, right? So your friends at the NBME, I don't know, for whatever reason, this is something you started caring about this year, right? Obviously, the answer is going to be fetal bradycardia. But many people don't understand, why is that the case? Well, think about it. When you see variable D cells, right? Hopefully you still remember the Veil-Chopp mnemonic that I talked about in my OB-GYN video, right? So the Veil-Chopp mnemonic, right? So remember, the V is variable D cell, right? And then the C means cord compression. When you compress the umbilical cord, remember the umbilical cord transmits those fetal blood vessels, right? Remember, a fetus has two umbilical arteries and one umbilical vein, right? So two umbilical arteries and one umbilical vein. The thing is, if you compress the umbilical cord, you're going to compress the umbilical arteries. And if you compress the umbilical arteries, what do you think is going to happen to the systemic vascular resistance? The systemic vascular resistance is going to go up, right? And if that systemic vascular resistance goes up, guess what? the blood pressure in the fetus is going to go up. And if the blood pressure in the fetus goes up, you're going to be banging on those baroreceptors, right? That rest around like the carotids, right? So you bang on those baroreceptors. When you bang on those baroreceptors, that's going to cause a parasympathetic discharge. And when you have that parasympathetic discharge, you're going to have a decreased speed of conduction down the AV node, right? So the fetus is going to be bradycardic. That is actually what presents on the fetal heart rate tracing as a variable D cell. A variable D cell is you're literally decelerating, right? If you remember college physics, you're literally going from an elevated fetal heart rate, right, to something that is a lower value, right? So the mechanism behind that deceleration in cord compression is because you're increasing systemic vascular resistance, and then essentially those baroreceptors are giving you a parasympathetic discharge. Again, I know in this podcast, some of you may be like, man, the fucking discussing some really weird, bizarre stuff here. But I promise you, these things are very high yields to know, especially so for the step 2 CK exam. So I've gone for like 20 minutes now. I think maybe I'll go ahead and pause here since this is like a rapid review series. Again, I'm going to make more. Really, my biggest limitation in some sense has kind of been time. So, you know, hopefully over the next few days, I'll begin to make more and more podcasts. And as I do at the end of every podcast, please subscribe to the YouTube channel, right? Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. I'm going to be putting this on there. And then this podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on Spotify. And I will also encourage you to please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, with an S at the end, podcasts.com, right? So if you subscribe, if I make a new podcast, you're gonna get like an email notification and things like that. And then the quick life lesson I just want to share today is the problems with laziness, right? So problems with laziness. One thing I've noticed, right? And don't get me wrong, I won't be saying this if this is not, like many times when I make podcasts, I try to make it on problems that are common to healthcare professionals. The thing is, whether you like it or not, it's not everyone that actually goes into med school that is hardworking. There are just some people that are just, to be honest with you, just flat out lazy, right? They're just flat out lazy. They don't want to work hard. They don't want to do anything, right? They just want to get a 270 by studying for 2 hours a day for 2 weeks, right? Again, that's not how life works. And to be honest with you, you probably on your own would not want that kind of physician. So again, I'll encourage you to work hard. Again, hard work, it's called hard work for a reason. It's work that is hard. But the thing is, at the end of the day, the benefits of hard work far outweigh the amount of effort you're putting in the first place, right? But whenever you see a person that is lazy, right? Yes, they may be putting in low effort. They may feel good now. But the thing is, the consequences of that low effort they've put in over time will begin to show forth in the future, right? Like, the thing is, you're going to work hard in some way. It's just the point at which you put in the hard work that will be different, right? If, for example, you put in the hard work with studying well for your exam, studying really hard, right? And then you do well on step one, you do well on step two CK, and then, you know, you apply for residency. You're going to get a ton of interviews. You're going to match easily. It's not going to be a big deal, right? But the thing is, if, for example, you don't put in as much work as you're supposed to on studying for step one, studying for step two CK, and you get very poor scores, they're going to put a lot of hard work into your application. But the thing is, you're putting in hard work at a time where that hard work may not pay off. Because the thing is, the fact that you work hard, it doesn't mean the work is going to pay off. There's some people that really work hard that get no result from it, right? The two reasons why people may work hard, I mean, there are many reasons for this, but the two primary reasons why people may work hard, especially in medicine, and not get much from it is they are working hard at the wrong time, right? Like the case of the person that is working hard when application season has come, instead of working hard when they should have done better on their exams. That's one. But the second thing that makes people have fruitless hard work, right, is they work hard in the wrong kind of work, right? So the thing is, again, like, I know this thing happens in medical school a lot where, you know, you are starting a new class, you're like, oh, this is the resource I'm going to use to study for this exam, right? But then you notice, like, some classmate of yours has, like, this big ginormous book that this person is using, and you're like, wow, this book looks way bigger, right? Oh, wow, this person has matured 20,000 XYZ Anki deck, and I've not done any of those things, right? And then you start doing those things, even if they don't necessarily work for you. Let me tell you, folks, that is not prudent at all, right? So the thing is, the fact that something works for one person, it does not mean that that is the same thing that worked for you. Again, there's this saying that there are many roads to Jerusalem, right? In fact, there's this part of the Bible that says that there's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end is destruction, right? So that way you may think is right may actually be something that will lead to your own destruction, right? So what I'm saying is find your own correct path, right? Find your own correct path. It's not everyone that's meant to succeed with Anki. It's not everyone that's meant to succeed with listening to videos or podcasts. It's not everyone that's meant to succeed with writing notes. But find what works for you and use it to your own benefit. I mean, many of you can probably surmise at this point that from my podcast that I'm not a big Anki user. Anki is great, but I just don't use it. But I've done really well on exams, thankfully, right? By using the study approach that works best for my own disposition. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up here today. Thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and God bless you. Thank you.